This is Fresh Air. For those of us who feel our lives are often in chaos, the scientific theory of chaos offers some interesting analogies. The best-selling book, Chaos, was written by my guest, James Glick. He's a science writer who used to be with the New York Times. He left the paper to write books. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the late physicist Richard Feynman. Glick describes Feynman as the most brilliant, iconoclastic, and influential physicist of modern times, the architect of quantum theories, the brash young group leader on the atomic bomb project, inventor of the Feynman diagram, and an ebullient bongo player and storyteller. Within the community of physicists, his name took on a special luster. It was permitted in connection with Feynman to use the word genius. Here's one of the reasons why.
There was a tremendous crisis just after the war in this new business of quantum mechanics. It seemed to work. It was very mysterious, as everyone knows. It gave sort of rough answers that looked right, but when physicists tried to calculate things more precisely, they discovered that the answers just went wild. They got infinity where they were supposed to be getting a real number. And this, of course, was on the heels of their great public triumph in creating the atomic bomb, which proved for the first time that physics really wasn't just something esoteric. It was something that could change all of our lives. So here they had this obscure crisis, and Feynman, a very young man, solved it at the same time as two other great physicists, Julian Schwinger, another American, and Sinitaro Tominaga, a Japanese. They all solved this problem independently. Schwinger and Tominaga solved it in a sort of traditional way, in a way that was instantly recognized, even though it was very difficult to use. Feynman solved it in a completely different way, in a way that was very visual. It relied on these sort of stick figure diagrams for particle interactions that are now called Feynman diagrams, and they're absolutely everywhere in physics. And at first, he had a terrible time getting this across. It wasn't rigorous mathematically. It was so different. J. Robert Oppenheimer, who had known Feynman from their work together on the atomic bomb and was now a sort of leader of the physics community, at first didn't trust Feynman's solution at all. He really had to be persuaded. There was a very weird couple of years when Feynman was almost in despair. And yet now, it is Feynman's methods that are universally used, and they've turned out to have application not just to this problem, but to the very newest areas of physics and cosmology, too.
Let's talk a little bit about Feynman's work with the creation of the atom bomb. He worked on the Los Alamos project when he was in his 20s. He headed the theoretical division of the atom bomb project. What were some of his specific contributions?
He was a group leader within the theoretical division. He was very young, and even to be a group leader was a remarkable amount of responsibility for someone just out of graduate school to be given on this project. He, interestingly, downplayed his own role afterwards. When he talked about Los Alamos, he always talked about cracking safes and tormenting the censors and playing tricks on the military authorities there. At one point, he sort of led a rebellion of the bachelors in one of the men's dormitories about the patrols of MPs. I mean, he presented himself as a cut-up. All of which was partly true, but wasn't, I don't think, the essence of his role there. And the fact is that Oppenheimer said at the time, that he had realized that Feynman was the most brilliant of the young physicists working on the project.
I know for some of the physicists who worked on the creation of the atom bomb, the real meaning of the bomb changed for them after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What was the psychological impact of the actual use of the bombs?
We forget
on him.
We forget now what the mood was. I mean, it's so easy for us to think, as so many people have said to me, how could a likable guy you admire, have done this terrible thing? How could anybody have worked on this project in the first place? In a way, the first thing you have to do to answer that question is to understand the psychology that existed before the bomb was dropped, when they were working on the project. Almost everyone, and it was certainly true of Feynman, did it enthusiastically. They were patriotic. They wanted to serve their country. They wanted to create this weapon. There weren't doubts. Oppenheimer, of course, always said that at the moment of the Trinity test, he had said, he had remembered this line from the Bhagavad Gita, "Now we are become death, destroyer of worlds." And that kind of guilt permeated people's memories and later accounts. But I think the first thing we have to remember is that that guilt wasn't there for almost any of them at the time, and it wasn't there for Feynman. They were thrilled when that bomb went off successfully at Trinity, and they were also thrilled when the first news started coming back from Hiroshima. They actually celebrated the dropping of that bomb. It's shocking, but I don't think we can understand the mentality of the time unless we recognize it. Afterward, things changed for a lot of them, and certainly for Feynman, and the guilt did begin to sink in. They realized that the Germans hadn't been working on the bomb, and they realized also that they had known that before their work was finished. In a way, the best thing I heard on this subject was something Freeman Dyson said. It was that it wasn't just that they had created this thing that made the scientists feel so guilty. It was that they had so much fun doing it.
Was that borne out by what you read of Feynman's work?
Yeah, it's true. Feynman, like so many people there, always thought back to Los Alamos as one of the great experiences of his life. It was a wonderful place. They were isolated. They were fenced in. It was a community and a very international community. Brilliant people from all over the world, thrown together with this fantastic sense of purpose. People who were used to just writing stuff on blackboards suddenly had to apply all of their skills toward a goal. There was tremendous satisfaction in it. Now, afterward, Feynman, like some of the others, felt guilty. Feynman was absolutely in despair in the years after the war, although it didn't show outwardly. And he confided in some of his intimate friends that he would go around the country and he would see people building bridges or building houses and think, they're crazy. They don't know what's coming, that there is going to be a nuclear war. Why are they bothering to build things when everything's just going to be destroyed?
My guest is science writer James Gleick. His new book is a biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. The book is called Genius. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Science writer James Gleick is my guest. He wrote the bestseller Chaos. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the physicist Richard Feynman. Now, I want to ask you a couple of things about chaos. I still find it hard to understand that there's actually a system to describe chaos. It seems like such a contradiction in terms.
Well, it does, and that's why it took so long for people to discover this new kind of science. So much of the science that we're taught in school, and this is still true, it was certainly true in Feynman's era, the practical science, has to do with things that are linear, things that can be described in terms of the equations that one can calculate. And those tend to be linear equations, nonlinear equations, where things shift uneasily as one element of the equation changes, are much more difficult. So the physics that we tend to be brought up with describes, perforce, a fairly orderly world. I mean, after all, science began with an orderly world. It began with people discovering regularities in the middle of what was mostly incomprehensible. You know, the sun rising and falling on a recognizable schedule, the motions of the planets, and most of that stuff did create a very powerful science, but mostly applicable to orderly things. It was only in the 60s and 70s especially that people started to discover that some of the rest of the territory, discontinuities, erratic behavior, turbulence in fluids, the arrhythmic writhing of the human heart in fibrillation, erratic behavior of lasers, the unpredictable behavior of the Earth's weather, all of these phenomena that seem to be past the edge, uncomputable and separate, actually could be described, not predicted in a simple sense, but described with this remarkable new theory that luckily or unluckily got the name of chaos.
I wonder if you think part of the reason why people became so involved in this theory of chaos, and I'll mention your book was a bestseller, is because it just the word alone describes what we feel. You know, and I'm thinking, for instance, like when I learned about entropy, the kind of physical, the physics principle that things evolve toward disorder, I thought, great, my life, you know, my life, my house, my office, just everything around me. And I just really embraced entropy for a while. I thought, you know, this is a kind of a principle that just describes the way the world seems to me.
Right.
Do you think that has something to do with the interest in chaos?
We certainly do look to science for lessons about things that we just understand. And there are lessons from chaos, I think, that are very appealing to all of us. And
like what?
One of the first things that you hear about when you learn about chaos is the butterfly effect, the notion that in the Earth's weather, the flapping of a butterfly's wings today in New York can cascade upward through the atmosphere so rapidly that it can affect the course of huge storm systems 4 weeks from now on the other side of the globe. That's an extraordinary thing and quite counterintuitive, quite a surprise to professional meteorologists. And it's the heart of why, with the enormous increase in computing power, we still can't make good weather forecasts any farther into the future than 4 or 5 days. Well, we know from our own lives that small causes can have enormous consequences. You leave the house 10 seconds late and a flower pot hits your head, or more seriously, you miss a bus and you're 10 minutes late, and then the bus misses the train and you're an hour late. We know that I mean, it's the for want of a nail, the kingdom was lost syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So why should it have been such a surprise to scientists? Well, science was based on the opposite being true, that if you can approximate things pretty well at the beginning of a chain of calculation, when you get to the end of the chain of calculation, you'll still have an answer that is approximately right. I mean, that's what lets you send a spaceship to Neptune and have some confidence that it's going to end up pretty much where you calculated it was going to be. Sure, there are going to be small uncertainties at the beginning, but they won't blow up. It turns out that in a lot of systems, a lot of chaotic systems, they do blow up. In fact, that's what defines a chaotic system. So in a way, science has had to catch up with something that we know from our own lives just by common sense.
Is there anything that you have learned in your years of science writing that has become a kind of guiding metaphor for your life, some physical principle that has become a metaphor for you?
In a way, I think I've learned that we have to be careful about drawing too many lessons from science. We look to science for metaphors. You know, we talked a little bit about entropy and the second law of thermodynamics, and chaos is another one. And it's proper to do that, but we also have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important lesson from science is the lesson that Feynman emphasized throughout his whole life, and that is a kind of skeptical mentality. The essence of being a scientist is to be skeptical, not to believe things, but to disbelieve them. If you're really an honest scientist, as Feynman always was, you have to look at your theory and not think, why is this likely to be right? You have to look at it and think, what are all of the ways I could be fooling myself? How could this go wrong? Feynman was loved by experimentalists because he would come in and he would listen to the way they had done a calculation. You know, a calculation might have involved making a series of approximations, and at some point you have to stop. And Feynman would say, why did you stop there? Did you stop because that was the answer that you were expecting to get? Or did you make up a plan before you did the calculations that forced you to stop at a certain point? He would keep people honest. And I think that skeptical attitude helped him not just be a great scientist, but have the right understanding of things like UFOs and parapsychology. And Feynman always actually had a lot of fun poking holes in this sort of thing, going after people who claimed to be able to bend spoons and really explaining what was wrong with it in a way that I think all of us can understand. You would think that in this era when we can turn on the television and see images beamed from outer space. We can see what the Earth looks like. And at the same time, we can see images from the tiniest crevices of our bodies, that we would have a more rational consensus on what's true and what isn't. And yet, of course, that's not the case. We are bombarded with ideas and with theories, and in a way, we sometimes seem to be more confused than ever.
James Gluck, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Gluck is the author of the bestseller Chaos. His new book, Genius, is a biography of the late physicist Richard Feynman. This is Fresh Air.